Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today we talk ice cream, the coolest, dreamiest, creamiest ice cream. But it doesn't follow the rules from classic ice cream school. This ice cream is easy to make at home with a $45 ice cream maker, no less. Now you're going to meet a woman who step-by-step figured out a goof-proof formula and built a business on it.
Everything you add to ice cream plays a role in the final texture. And when I created this recipe, I was trying to mimic the exact texture and the body of the ice cream that I get in my professional kitchen with professional equipment, with pasteurizers, homogenizers, really expensive gelato machines from Italy, and very, very cold freezers. At home, that's very difficult because you have limitations in your home kitchen. So I started from the texture and consistency that I wanted and worked backward.
That's Jenny Britton Bauer, author of Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream Desserts. Stay with us for this and a lot more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Getting right into the heart of the matter today, taking on summer heat with the pinnacle food of the season, ice cream. Jenny Britton Bauer could be Central Casting's perfect milkmaid, and she makes ice cream, no less. Not ho-hum ice cream. She does sweet corn and black raspberry, Savannah buttermint, goat cheese ice cream with roasted cherries. She's created Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream Shops in Columbus. Now, critics say her ice creams are up there with some of the best in the United States. So it's no surprise that Jenny's done a book. Now, what intrigues me are her ice cream recipes. They aren't like any I've seen before. The book is called Jenny's Splendid Ice Creams at Home, and Jenny's here in the studio, and I am in dairy heaven because I have got ice cream all around me. I love this. Jenny, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So you open this book with the most curious statement for someone who's going to tell us how to make homemade ice cream. You say you really don't like homemade ice cream. So yeah. What's the deal here?
Yeah, I've never liked homemade ice cream. Sorry, Grandma. I didn't like the ice cream that was made at home on the deck or on the porch because we had a Häagen-Dazs down the street, and I just wanted to go there. The texture of the American Scoop Shop ice cream, where they rolled it into a ball and put it on a cone, was perfect. I loved that hard ice cream and licking it off a cone.
But what was wrong with the homemade ice cream?
It was always a little bit icy. It had to be served soft.
Uh-huh.
And then when you froze it hard, it would get crumbly and it would fall off my cone.
All right. Because I cannot wait any longer, this is the point where I want to taste your ice cream and then I want to hear how you got to it. So you've scooped out three different ice creams. What's here?
That's our lemon yogurt with a blueberry sauce that we make in our kitchen. We buy an entire field of blueberries from Ohio.
You don't fool around, do you?
No, and we make this every year. It's one of our most popular flavors. Now, it's a lemon yogurt. It's fresh yogurt. Fresher. We just take it out of the tubs.
Uh-huh.
Fresh grass-fed cream.
Right.
Sugar and tons of fresh squeezed lemon juice and some lemon zest.
Okay.
And then a swirl of blueberry sauce that we make.
All right, so I'm going to taste this. This is frozen yogurt, essentially.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Now, yogurt gives it a wonderful tartness, which, of course, so does the lemon.
But the thing about this is there's layers of tartness. And there's creaminess. My goodness.
And the grass-fed cream actually has a really creamy finish in the nose.
Tasting is not possible here. You want to eat the whole thing. Okay, now, this is the next ice cream. What have I got here?
Oh, that is our Rock Mill. Rock Mill is a brewery south of Columbus, and they do a Belgian beer. So the cream is flavored with golden ale, and then it has an apricot swirl that we make in our kitchen. And we swirl it through all by hand.
Oh, boy. That tastes exactly like Belgian. I mean, it's
all in your nose.
It really is.
And that's what's so great about butterfat. It just holds onto those flavors, and then as soon as it melts on your palate, it explodes into your nose.
Okay, but there's a real density here again.
That's right.
Okay, now the third ice cream, what have I got?
That's our brown butter almond brittle. We did this for a Norwegian collection we did. It's actually Roald Dahl's favorite, rumored to have been his favorite flavor.
Oh, my.
We make a brown butter almond brittle, and it's a brown butter ice cream. Plenty of sea salt.
You know, the thing about your flavors is that they sing. I mean, they really are distinctive. But there's a couple of things in your recipes I've not seen in other ice cream recipes. Every recipe has cream cheese in it. Every recipe has a little bit of corn syrup. Every recipe has a cornstarch slurry. That's cornstarch mixed with liquid. And every recipe has the same balance of 2 cups of milk to 1¼ cups of heavy cream. So why always this formula for your ice creams? And what does this have to do with texture?
Everything you add to ice cream plays a role in the final texture. And when I created this recipe, I was trying to mimic the exact texture and the body of the ice cream that I get in my professional kitchen with professional equipment, with pasteurizers, homogenizers, really expensive gelato machines from Italy, and very, very cold freezers. So at home, that's very difficult because you have limitations in your home kitchen. You're just, you know, you don't have a pasteurizer, homogenizer. So I started from the texture and consistency that I wanted and worked backward. So the cream cheese adds a little bit of body. It's an ingredient that I added just at the last minute to give it a little scoopability.
Intense protein also, right?
It is protein, and it's a different kind of protein than the other protein that we work with in the ice cream mix, which is when we boil the milk and cream and the two sugars, sucrose, which is table sugar, and glucose in form of corn syrup or tapioca syrup, both those sugars function differently in the overall base, and they hold water in different ways. Water is your enemy in ice cream. That's what turns into ice. And everything that you add to ice cream, almost everything, has water in it. Milk is 87% water, and water turns into ice cream crystals in the final product. So you have to bind water to something else, protein, fat, sugar, or starch.
Jenny, you've got these incredible combinations, you know, the sweet basil with the honeyed pine nut and cucumber and melon. Is there one thing you could tell us about how to get really intense flavor in ice cream?
Well, a couple of things. For fruits that are high in water, a lot of times we'll roast them with some sugar to bind some of the water to sugar and also to evaporate some of that water and concentrate the flavors.
Ah.
And then also we steep a lot of ingredients right in the cream. So either you go with a hot steep, which is for barky ingredients like cinnamon or leather ingredients like vanilla, or you go with a cold steep for the green leaves like anything that grows in your backyard and it's fresh.
Basil,
that kind
of
mint,
thing.
Caramel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How long did it take for you to put all these pieces together?
It took months. With ice cream, and I'm sure with a lot of other things too, you have to think about what the home cook has to use. And we built a whole test kitchen, just a home kitchen in the back of my office.
So that you could do this.
Yeah, yeah.
And you used a $45 ice cream maker.
I did. I have about 30 of them. All paid for by me, by the way. No sponsorships.
Oh, boy. Well, Jenny, thanks so much. And thanks so much for the ice creams. We're going to be digging in.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Jenny Brittenbauer is author of Jenny's Splendid Ice Cream Desserts. Now, you can find that recipe for lemon and blueberry frozen yogurt. It's sensational. On the website, splendidtable.org.
One, two, you know what to do. All right.
Remember that meat dress of Lady Gaga's? That was not a new idea. I mean, many years ago, 120 years ago, curvy models were being wrapped in salami gowns for poster ads in Italy. And today, Katie McLaughlin of The Wall Street Journal is here with a new report on food in fashion. So, Katie, welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Lynn. It's so great to be here.
All right, so Lady Gaga was not the first, right?
Amazingly, no. There was another meat dress, and there may have been others, but I discovered at least one that came before Lady Gaga's famous meat dress.
What was it like? Who did it?
It was done by a commercial photographer, and he teamed up with a really wacky New York costume designer named Amy Goodhart, and they put together this photo shoot, this is a couple years ago, where they made all of these amazing outfits out of food ingredients. So one of them was made out of meat. It was pieces of flank steak that were kind of cut into petals assembled into a dress. And they also made outfits out of waffles, and somebody was dressed up in pasta. There was a beautiful, beautiful gown that they made out of artichoke hearts. It's totally gorgeous. You have to look at it closely to figure out that it's made out of artichokes. The image of it, which you can find online if you Google artichoke dress, there's a beautiful model, and she's standing in an elegant pose, sort of picture a Christian Dior advertisement from the 50s, wearing this sweeping gown that has a beautiful train, and it's a strapless dress, you know, that just sort of hugs her torso. Mm-hmm. And as you look closer, you see that in this green and purple coloring, there's texture, and you look a little closer and you realize, oh, wait, I know that texture. I had it for dinner last night.
But you really started digging into this subject of food as fashion. What else did you find?
Well, I started to notice, and it was one of those things where I was saying, am I nuts or am I actually seeing this? That there were a plethora of images of food clothing. And the biggest one was the Barney's Christmas catalog this year featured all of these gorgeous models and expensive clothes, and then the models would be wearing like kale on their head as a hat or an octopus laying over their head as a kind of a ski cap, or necklaces made out of cherries. And I thought, wow, there's the food clothing thing again. Then there was the singer Katy Perry did an album cover where she's sort of laying in a bed of cotton candy, and the artist who had made that image specializes in images of beautiful women wearing cakes on their head or candy dresses. PETA, the animal rights organization, had done a bunch of ads where they had well-known celebrities like Cloris Leachman and Alyssa Milano wearing, again, beautiful gowns made out of cabbage leaves or asparagus. I think Alyssa Milano was wearing a bodice made of asparagus. And then the Salon du Chocolat, which is a trade show, a chocolate trade show, now goes all over the world, and the hallmark of this event is a fashion show in which models walk down the runway wearing clothes made out of chocolate.
Chocolate melts at 98.6 body heat.
It's a problem. It's a problem. So as I talked to some of the designers, one of my designers said, well, the most important thing when you're making a dress out of chocolate is to keep it away from the armpit area. You know, very practical thinking there. So I start thinking, what the heck is going on? Why are we seeing all of these images in advertising and fine art? Some of the people I've spoken to, I spoke to some professors at Parsons School of Design, and I spoke to some of the fashion thinkers behind the Barney's catalog, and they talked about food having emerged now in our culture as a very positive kind of source of symbols about our culture. I mean, if I said to you, oh, he's a guy who eats a Big Mac every day, you could automatically place that person socially, or you would think you could. Mm-hmm. Or if I said, oh, well, if you go to her house, you won't find anything that's not organic in her refrigerator. That also says a lot about somebody, about their values or their aspirations. Food today, certain kinds of food, can connote at the same time sophistication and caring. You know, somebody who's both sophisticated and also really cares about the environment.
Interesting.
The people who create images, you know, that have to say a lot just in a glance, they are now using that symbology and kind of taking advantage of the great reputation that food and foodies and cuisine have right now.
Oh, Katy, I can't wait to see what you're going to dig into next. Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Katy McLaughlin's piece on food and fashion appeared in the Wall Street Journal. Fruit tarts are my expression of fashion this year. I'm doing some retro-style crusts. They're half whole wheat flour with brown sugar, cinnamon, and orange peel, kind of like a not-too-sweet cookie. And these flavors are good with melon and stone fruits. Now, I bake just the crust early in the morning before the heat sets in, and then I fill them later. Now, I've tried topping them with labneh, you know, that yogurt cheese. You just drain the yogurt overnight in a strainer so it gets really thick. And then you can sweeten it to taste with honey, and you flavor it with yogurt. Now, you dop that on the baked crust, and then you pile on the fruit. Then I even finished it with zigzags of boiled down balsamic vinegar and some honey and grated orange zest. Look, this really isn't a recipe. It's an improv. So try your own. Well, more's coming up. Food as political might, and the coolest salads of summer. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. In every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking an amazing meal. Listen as Ina does what she does best, make good conversation and delicious food while making it sound fun and easy. This season, Ina dives into conversation with astronaut and colonel Nicole Mann. As Ina teaches Nicole how to make seared scallops with celery root puree, they talk about everything from family to what foods Nicole really craves when she's in space. And listen in as Ina and Pulitzer Prize-winning writer David Remnick talk about music lessons and the value of developing language skills before joining their spouses for a lively conversation over a comforting dish of chicken parmesan. If you love a good chat over a great meal, you'll love Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Two expressions, nearly identical. The power of food, or food as power. Like a double-edged sword, one side says nurture, comfort. The other side says control, and perhaps danger. This is the tricky edge that much of the world totters on. And for a deeper understanding, we're turning to Politico's editor, Susan Glasser, who joins us from Washington. Susan, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Susan, thinking of food as power, there was one piece in the issue that comes to mind, and it was called Eat, Drink, Protest, Buying Peace One Feast at a Time. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, think about what's been happening in the Middle East over the last few months, and something extraordinary clearly has occurred, but it's something extraordinary that actually is part of a long tradition, I think, of food and power in the Middle East, which is really, really captured by several of the writers in this issue of our magazine. And for me, one scene sticks in mind. It's Christmas time in Lebanon, 2006. Remember the conflict there and the effort on the part of Iranian-backed Hezbollah to topple the Lebanese government. Our author recalls sitting in one of the main squares, I've been there in downtown Beirut, surrounded by young men, shababs they call themselves, students that means. They've been in the streets for days. They're poor, they're hungry, but they're there to express a political moment. What happens? Just as a young man is saying, who will feed us? Out appears the activists of Hezbollah. What are they offering? Are they offering ideology? Are they offering Marxist slogans? No, of course not. They're offering freshly cooked turkeys to all the protesters who are willing to come out and spend the time and risk themselves to topple the government in Lebanon. And I think this metaphor of, you know, turkey as political statement, you know, is something that really captures one's attention. And in the volatile Middle East in particular, this is a region where dictators, and there have been many of them, have been playing with food, trying to use it and its distribution to maintain their hold on power for centuries. And when they have failed to do so, found themselves tottering as a result.
What are some of the examples from the past?
Well, you know, this it really goes back a remarkably long time. There's an old Arabic word called the simat, and, you know, you can trace this history even to the ancient Assyrians inviting, you know, something like 70,000 of their subjects to come and celebrate a massive victory parade. You know, feasting is a sign of power. The distribution or conversely the withholding of food goes back a long, long time. And of course is very much relevant to the present day when we see food prices skyrocketing and hitting all-time global highs. And the Middle East is one of the most food insecure regions in the world where they're heavily dependent on imports and therefore on the market price of food. What we've seen in Egypt and in Libya and Tunisia is that these were food importing countries. All of the dictators in the region used various forms of subsidies of food to control their populations, to win goodwill, such as it was. There's no question that the food-related instability as the prices shot up contributed, I think, to the destabilization of the situation in Egypt. Mubarak frantically tried to offer more subsidies as it became clear that the prices were spinning out of control, but it was too late for him in particular. Libya, in addition to Egypt, Egypt is actually the world's single largest importer of food, and Libya is one of the most food import-dependent countries in the world. Saudi Arabia, of course, is running its own aquifer dry and will soon be once again entirely dependent on 100% of its wheat will have to come soon again from outside the country.
There are pictures on your site. There's a whole slideshow. And it shows the protesters in different countries. And the thing that was so striking about this was so many of them are holding up loaves of bread.
Well, you know, there's many resonant sayings in Arabic that go directly to this, and they all boil down to this. Bread is a substitute, a shorthand in Arabic for human dignity. And the lack of bread or the lack of ability to provide one's family with bread is at its most basic level showing that the compact with the state has been broken. And, I found it amazing as well that there were so many pictures, if you looked in these protests for, basically baguette-wielding young men. And that started in Tunisia, of course, with its French tradition, which is probably where the baguette came into it as a symbol. One of our other authors in this issue, Anna Bodkin, also the author of a memoir about sort of food in war zones. Anna writes very memorably about a picture that she saw of a young protester in Yemen who had gone out girded for uneven combat, if you will, with the regime's forces. And he literally has strapped around his head two baguettes wrapped around there with tape on his head as a form of armor. And she dubbed him very memorably Bread Helmet Man. And I think that's a symbol of this yearning for human dignity in its most straightforward form.
Fascinating. Susan, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Susan Glasser is editor of Politico. This week, The Splendid Table joined the launch of the Infinite Guest Podcast Network. Along with us, you're going to find 11 other shows to listen to, including A Tiny Sense of Accomplishment with authors Sherman Alexie and Jess Walter. Hear more at infiniteguest.org, where the conversation never ends, in a good way. Asian salads, especially Vietnamese noodle salads, are cool and fragrant, and frankly, they're sexy. I mean, there's slippery noodles, the crunch of fresh vegetables, warmed pieces of grilled bits, finished with fragrant herbs. I mean, this is irresistible. Andrea Nguyen is the master of all things Asian. She's author of Into the Vietnamese Kitchen. Andrea, good to have you back with us.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
Andrea, I want to talk to you about Vietnamese salads. Can you give us the basics?
Sure, Lynn. You know, this time of the year is a great time to make these cool noodle salads. And the operative word here is cool noodle. And the noodle is a little rice noodle called bun. It's spelled like bun, B-U-N, but we pronounce it bun, like B-O-O-N. And they're these little round rice vermicelli noodles. And what you do is you boil them up in water, like a regular pasta, for, I don't know, maybe 3 to 5 minutes until they're chewy tender, and then, you know, drain them, flush them with water, and let them sit there and cool. And what they do is they're going to get a little sticky and firm up, and then you can let them sit there like for hours while you're getting ready everything else. And you can put whatever you want on them. We make a salad, a mixture of lettuce and different kinds of herbs. Vary it. Cilantro, mint, you know, whatever kinds of herbs that you've got grown in your garden, just slice them up, you know, and mix sort of like a mixture of chopped greens and herbs. And then that's the foundation. Got a little cucumber? Throw it in there. A little carrot or daikon? Throw it in there too. Then you put your noodles on top. Then this is where the fun part is, the protein aspect. If you have leftover grilled food, cut up into little slices. You know, lamb is great, pork, beef. Grill a little shrimp, put it on there, chicken, fabulous. And then if you want a little chopped, roasted, unsalted peanuts. And the sauce for the dressing is the ubiquitous Vietnamese nước chấm, which is the fish sauce and lime juice and sugar, a little chili. And you put that on the side. What I like to do is actually set it all up and then let people go at it and make their own bowl. So, you know, you can craft this out of even a stir fry if you'd like, a leftover stir fry, and put it on top. My family ate this for Sunday morning breakfast. You know, we skipped the donuts in the church hall afterwards, and we'd go home and make these kinds of salads, and they're perfect for summer.
Do you ever soak your noodles? Because I've used the technique where you just pour hot water, very hot water, over the noodles and let them soak. Am I violating a rule by doing that?
Well, I think that one of the things that I've come across when people think about these noodles is that they sometimes use super fine rice noodles that are almost like hair-like. And that is the type of noodle where you can just boil water over. What you sometimes also come across is people using cellophane or glass noodles instead of the rice noodle.
Oh, yeah. Those are the ones that are clear. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And technically, you only use them in certain rice paper rolls, but it's the white rice noodle that you use. And you can't just pour hot water over them. Sorry, Lynn. You got to boil them.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. Check that one. Now, the other question is, after you've boiled these noodles and you've rinsed them, do you have to rinse them under water, or do you just drain them off?
You want to flush them with a lot of cold water because there's residual starch. That'll get the noodles to clump together in the colander. One of the things that I learned from my mother that I still do today is I have the colander in the sink, and I put an inverted rice bowl or a glass or something in the center, in the bottom of the colander. You pour your noodles in, and that way the noodles kind of form around the bowl or the glass, and they don't clump, you know, way at the bottom of the colander, mm-hmm. and they separate mm-hmm. a lot easier.
Interesting. So anything can really go into this salad, but the layering is generally the greens go on the bottom of the bowl, then the noodles go on, then whatever the proteins might be, and then some herbs on top of that and nuts. Is that the basic kind of formation of it? And that's it.
Yeah. You know, and if you wanted to have some fun, you could put some rice papers out and they can like roll them up and have a roll your own bar.
That sounds fabulous. Hey, Andrea, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Andrea Nguyen is the author of Into the Vietnamese Kitchen and the app The Asian Market Shopper. You can find her recipe for rice noodle bowl on the website splendidtable.org. Traveling the countryside for good eats is Jane and Michael Stern's shtick, and they do it for their road food site and for us. Jane, Michael, where have you guys been?
We have been traveling the Tenderloin Belt in the southern Midwest, from central Indiana into Iowa, in Illinois, maybe up into Minnesota a wee bit. The word tenderloin in this part of the country does not necessarily refer to that piece of meat that you and I know as a tenderloin. It refers to a sandwich, formerly known as the breaded pork tenderloin sandwich. But when you go into a restaurant that serves it, you just say, I'd like a tenderloin.
And there's tremendous competition in this area for who has not only the best tenderloin sandwich, but who has the biggest one. If you've never seen one of these, just envision Oh, I guess a fried veal cutlet is the closest thing to it, but we're talking about pork. With a hamburger, a normal-sized hamburger bun, but this fried cutlet extending 10 inches out from beyond the bun.
This time, Jane is not exaggerating, because the biggest of these sandwiches are impossible to... Your fingers aren't long enough to get to the bun from the outside of it.
They look very much like old, like D movie from the 1950s, UFOs, you know, flying saucers, but they are absolutely delicious.
And the secret of a great one, as served at Nick's Kitchen in Huntington, Indiana, where indeed it may have been invented, there's some controversy. The secret to a good one is the balance, because pounded thin like that, the risk is you're going to lose the juiciness of the pork, which of course you don't want to do. On the other hand, it's the balance of pork and crunch that is essential. And you want that really wicked good crunch when you bite into it. Then you want to sink your teeth into that juicy pork. And the combination with mustard and pickle on top is sensational.
I think if you had to put this in a genre, maybe chicken fried steak would be comparable. Uh-huh.
Vaguely. But there's never any gravy on a tenderloin.
No.
And you'd never serve it with mashed potatoes. You might get a bag of potato chips
and
on the side.
And much thinner, too.
Yeah.
So is there any garnish on it?
The traditional garnish is pickles and mustard, but that's flexible. You can some places serve it with a slice of tomato, some places with lettuce.
But even whatever the garnish is, you've got like a 3.5-inch hamburger bun, you know, which you can put your garnishes in, but then you've still got this giant... the rings of Saturn,
right?
You know, sort of coming out that you're not going to put something on,
and those need to stand on their own.
Now, is there any idea of how this became a tradition in this area?
Well, I guess it has been and continues to be like a big pork raising area. Why it got focused there and why people are so passionate about it, I don't know. But as I said, Nick's Kitchen in Huntington claims that they invented it back in 1904 when they were really serving food from a street cart. And it continues to this day now in another family. But the woman that's been running it now, her father started running it back in the 1940s. And she is famous for great tenderloins as well as for real Midwest farmy pies that are
some
of the best.
Pies, they must specialize in great circular food in this part of the country, because you know you've got this big dinner plate of a pork tenderloin sandwich, and then homemade butterscotch pies that are to die for.
Not from pudding mix. I mean, real. Uh-huh. It's butterscotch pie that is probably a little bit more buttery than it is sweet. I've never had butterscotch like this.
Oh,
sensational.
Boy.
And this is also a place to get the signature dessert of Indiana, which is sugar cream pie. Kind of like chess pie, but without the cornmeal. It's basically cream, eggs, and sugar in a crust.
Yeah, it's sort of like pecan pie if you took all the pecans out of it.
Sounds pretty swell, guys. Thank you.
Take care, Lynn.
Bye-bye, Lynn.
For Jane and Michael Stern's very latest eating finds, head to roadfood.com and, of course, splendidtable.org. Now, we'll be back in a moment with your questions. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
You talk to me. Why don't you talk to me? I'm standing here alone. I know you'll never phone. Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk to me?
We're connecting with you, so get in touch. 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. Okay, let's get to it. We've got Jillian calling from Georgia. Jillian, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, hello, Lynn. Well, I grew up in England in the country, and I remember my mother making summer pudding every year when blackberries were in season.
Oh, yeah.
And it was absolutely wonderful, and years have gone by. I haven't made it. I've been checking out a few recipes, and a lot of them seem to have a lot of sugar in it, and I'm wondering if you have a wonderful recipe. My mother used to make it in a bowl, actually the same size bowls that she used to use for the Christmas pudding, and she would line it with white bread without the crusts on, and then she would make this wonderful concoction of blackberries and other berries if they were in season, and we had blackcurrants in the garden, we had other berries, and I'm assuming put a fair amount of sugar in it, and she would then stew it up lightly, pour it in to fill up the bowl, and then she'd put more crustless bread on the top, weight it down with a plate and some cans of soup on the top, and then keep it overnight so that during that time the juices would seep into the bread and you'd have this wonderful mixture of berries. You didn't really taste the bread as bread. It was just kind of a consistency to keep this wonderful concoction together.
So I would imagine when she stewed that fruit, she either didn't let it get super liquid or she cooked off any liquid so it was concentrated.
No, there was a lot of liquid in
there,
actually. So she would only stew it, I think, for a few minutes just to soften it enough and actually bring the... You put a little water in, I think, too, to really release the juice from the blackberries because the juice seemed to be the most important part.
This, I remember eating this in England one summer and it... It's very, very good.
It's delicious, and it's so easy.
Like. Yeah, it's so simple. You know what? I do not have a recipe, but one of your countrymen, Nigella Lawson, has a recipe.
Ah.
And it's on our website, splendidtable.org.
Okay, I will check it out.
And you know, one of the things I've always thought about was, why not do this with not only berries, but with stone fruits like peaches and plums. Does that ever happen?
You know, I've never seen it that way, but I don't see why not. And here in Atlanta, of course, we have peaches galore in the summer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember going to a market at one point where I could smell the peaches before I saw them. They were so fragrant. Mm-hmm. They were fabulous. But anyway, check out the website. It's Nigella Lawson. It's the her summer pudding.
I will try it, Lynn.
And you know what? You can always pull back on sugar.
Well, that's true.
And yeah. And you taste your fruit. If the fruit is tart, then you need a bit more, but you can always pull back a bit.
Okay. I'll try that.
Enjoy it. Oh,
all
I
right.
think it's going to be good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks. You can reach us, 800-537-5252, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. We've got Angelica on the line from Lemon Grove, California. Angelica, hi. What's on your mind?
I'm in a quandary, Lynn.
What's wrong?
Well, I'm being asked to mess with an icon. My son goes to youth groups on Wednesday nights, and it's our turn to bring treat. And the theme is variations on s'mores. How do you variate s'mores?
Oh.
I mean, it's a classic.
Oh, yeah. I see what you mean.
Yeah. How do you mess with that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can think of ways of doing it, but then I can think of all the boos and hisses that you get when you do it.
Well, okay. Well, it's to junior hires, you know. So on the one hand, you know, you can mess a little bit. On the other hand, you know, you get the ew.
Well, now, wait a minute, though. Let's think about this. How about you spread some peanut butter, crunchy peanut butter, on the graham crackers? Before you put the chocolate on, and then you put the marshmallow on. That's number one.
Okay.
Number two, you do, instead of the graham crackers, you do chocolate cookies. Okay.
Oh.
Okay. And then, you know, the chocolate on chocolate thing.
Okay, okay.
All right, okay. Then the other thing is that you do some sort of crackly chocolate bar, something crunchy. Something with crackly things in it.
Yeah, okay.
Right. And the other thing is dip the marshmallow as it comes off, roll it in crushed nuts.
Oh.
And then the chocolate bar number with the two graham crackers.
Wow. Okay, well, let me throw you a curveball.
Yeah.
I saw in the store one time, of course I can't find it now, lemon cookies.
That would be great.
But I couldn't think of the candy component.
Well, the candy component, Hey, what about jelly candies?
Ooh.
Hey, how about like fruit leather?
Oh, you got it. Absolutely.
And gummy worms.
Oh, God. Okay, wait a second. Okay, this is. I'm just thankful that this is going to be at somebody else's house.
Oh yeah, many many layers of newspaper.
Oh yeah, totally. Or on the back patio where they can hose it down.
You got it. You got it. Many layers of gummy worms would be just hysterical. And imagine them peeking out from the marshmallow and the
chocolate. Nice.
Oh,
okay.
I love it.
Thanks for the visual.
You know, the next thing you're going to see is there'll be, you know, Good Housekeeping is going to have an article.
You know it. Originally from The Splendid Table.
No. From Angelica in Lemon Grove, California. Just give us,
gummy worms.
Give us a cut.
I will. Absolutely.
Have fun with it.
Okay. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us 800-537-5252 or check us out on Facebook and Twitter or shoot us an email. SplendidTable.org. Well, Julie in Ohio has an interesting question. She says, when recipes call for mint, do they mean spearmint, peppermint, or does it matter? I have been waiting for somebody to ask this. It really does matter because peppermint can cancel out your ability to breathe and taste if it's really fresh. What they usually mean is spearmint, and recipe writers should say that. Spearmint is a gentle mint, and it has a sweet overtone to it. By the way, peppermint has its place, but it's really powerful, and used in the wrong place, it's just going to take over everything. So go for spearmint, and thanks, because this is the kind of question everyone should know the answer to. We've got Eric on the line from Pittsburgh. Eric, hi. What is on your mind, sir?
A couple years ago, we decided to plant a black currant bush in our backyard. And this year, we're getting an abundance of black currants. But outside of drying them or making jam, I really don't know what to do with them. I'm lucky where I work for a restaurant company, so I have access to like some of the best chefs in town, and they all just say, oh, just make jam.
Well, I mean, basically, making jam is not a bad idea. But by the way, there's a lot of ways to approach this. I mean, jam made with Cabernet, all right? And, you know, jam made with really nice port wine and shallots, jam made with sherry vinegar and a little bit of smoky sweet paprika. You see, I mean, there's all of that.
Sure.
So you're essentially making a sauce. And those also could be things that you freeze because they're really not going to have a heck of a lot of sugar in them that they're going to be totally preserved. So you can do sauces with them. And what happens often in cooking with things like black currants is that they're frozen, first of all, just, you know, whole. You spread them out on a cookie sheet and you freeze them. And then whenever you want to use them, you know, and you put them in a plastic bag. So whenever you want to use them, they go into the pan along with the port wine, maybe a bit of sugar, whatever herbs you want, usually some member of the onion family. And you sauté until they begin to break up and their juices come out and everything gets blended because they have that sweet, tart, fruity quality to them. And it's one of those, I can't quite describe it, but nothing can quite duplicate it kind of flavors.
For sure, yeah, because I picked one off and I ate it. I'm like, well, that's not entirely appealing. But it also
not raw, not yeah. Raw at all. But you cook it for a little while and it's really, really good. And it's kind of like rhubarb. You know what I mean? Rhubarb raw, it's, you know, who wants it? But you give it a little sugar and you give it a little heat and you're going to have something that's really, really good. And so this is the thing. First of all, freeze them for the winter.
Okay.
Because you're going to make anything savory that you think you would like to have a sweet yet fruity tart sauce and even something that has a bit of spice to it. This can go into the pan. This can go into the sauce. For instance, you make a giblet gravy for Thanksgiving.
Okay.
You throw these into the roasting pan with the turkey so that it picks up all the juices and that kind of thing. And then you boil this down with, you know, all the pan juices and you make the gravy. It'll be fabulous. It'll add this really kind of interesting fruity quality.
Yeah, that sounds like it would.
The other thing is cook them down with some sugar, okay, with a vanilla bean and add that to apple pie, add that to pear pie, peach pie, add that to cherry pie. And it's going to be just fabulous.
Okay, so it sounds like it could be like a good substitute also for like fresh cranberries then?
Yeah, absolutely, okay. Absolutely. And, I mean, on their own, if you always want to cook them, and you always want to cook them to the taste and the amount of sweetness that you find interesting.
Okay.
And I always give them a little pinch of salt along with the sugar. And a vanilla bean has never hurt any fruit like that. You know, it just gives it a little bit of mellowness. One of the great things to do is to make one of those wonderfully buttery sweet pie crusts and take a glass and cut out rounds of that crust and pile really thick cooked down black currants and put them in the center. And then, you know, you fold over three sides of that circle. It looks like a hamantaschen.
Okay.
You know, but you still have that thick jam on top and you bake that off. You brush it with a little egg and you bake that off. And it's so delicious. So, I mean, you got a lot you can do with these babies.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Oh, and by the way, all of that stuff, put that into homemade ice cream or just melt down a little, soften up some vanilla ice cream and just streak it through and then refreeze it.
Oh, that would be good.
And I'm going to stop now.
Yeah, you also gave me an idea since you said the onion family. I actually have a little ramp patch that I started in my backyard.
Well, there you go.
In the spring, I'll mix them together with some ramps.
There you go. I mean, you got a marriage made in heaven and it's all in the backyard.
Yeah, sounds good.
Hey, Eric, thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
You can call us 800-537-5252. Send us an email, splendidtable.org. Follow us on Twitter. Courtney does, and she wants to know what to do with her two big lavender plants. She loves to cook. Okay. Courtney, this is the thing about lavender. The scent is really the main event. There's also this, you know, it tastes a little bit the way it smells. So there's a couple of tricks. First of all, if you want anything to have that lavender scent and that lavender quality that has sugar in it, like cookies, a pie crust, etc., put the lavender in the sugar. Just put aside, you know, a bowl of sugar, stick lavender in it, and let it sit there. It's going to flavor it just the way a vanilla bean might. And by the way, if you put lavender and vanilla in your sugar, that combination is dynamite. And then you make a simple batch of cookies, and they're fabulous. The other thing you can do is take really great vanilla ice cream, all right? Take the lavender, steep the lavender in a little bit of sour cream or warm up some heavy cream, put the lavender in it, steep it for about a half hour, and then strain it. So it's like you're using that cream to make almost like a lavender tea. Whip the cream and fold it into softened vanilla ice cream and refreeze it. It's just fabulous. And if you want to leave the lavender buds in there, you'll get those little shots of purple. Panna cotta, again, it's that same idea. You put it in cream, you warm it up, it blossoms. The other thing a friend of mine does is he takes the little new potatoes that come in all through the summer, you know, those little guys that are like, you know, maybe marbles, and he sautés them until they start to get tender. And then he throws a handful of lavender in the pan with the butter that he's sauteing them with and salt and a little sugar to help them brown. And then he flames the whole thing with whiskey. Don't ask me what happens to the lavender, but the potatoes are fabulous. And somehow without the lavender, they're never as good. So there's a few ideas. Kate's on the line from Portland. I'm not sure if that's Oregon or if it's Maine.
Well, it would be nice if it was Maine, but it is Portland, and that's pretty good, too.
That's pretty swell, I think.
My husband and I just moved here, actually, from Brooklyn about 6 months ago, and we have found in our backyard here in Portland, we have a huge fig tree. Huge. And I have no clue what to do. I mean, I know I could make preserves, but I've already canned tons and tons of jam. So I'm trying to think of what to do with these figs.
Oh, this is going to be fun. Okay. First of all, slit them in half and grill them. Okay.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah. And what you do is you can brush them with honey or do a little butter first and then do the honey. And then what happens is you grill them on the unbrushed side first and then you flip them over and you get kind of butterscotch.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome.
I mean, that's really great. And then if you want spice, brush them with the butter and the honey, and then you sprinkle them with a little bit of ground chili. So you get the butterscotch that has spice in it as well.
Oh, my God. That's magical.
That's really magical. Then the other thing that you can do is you can make a tart crust, you know, whatever recipe you'd like. And then what you do is you take some ricotta, really good ricotta cheese, which in Portland is not a problem in getting.
Right.
And then you spread that on the tart crust. You've sweetened it however you'd like and flavored it. And you do those grilled figs. And you put it on top of the tart crust, and that becomes your dessert.
God.
Yeah, right? And, and then what you can do, too, is you can cut them in half, and you can grill them. And then you can stuff them with anything from chopped salami that you have taken some of the inside that you've pulled out, and you've mixed up with the fig with a little bit of minced shallot. You see, and then you can cut those in half into little wedges and you eat them as a snack.
I know, there's so many options, it sounds like. I didn't even think about salami, but that's awesome.
Yeah, because the saltiness and the spiciness.
Yes.
But you can take the fresh ones and you can dice them up and you can toss them with things like cured meats and, you know, a little onion and maybe, I'm just trying to think, you know, something that has a little kick to it. Olives.
Oh, right.
And that can become like a condiment that you pile on bread that you've brushed with, you know, oil and garlic, and it becomes like a little nibble that you have with drinks.
Oh, man. That would probably be more than a nibble for me. I would probably eat so much that it would be a dinner.
Well, yeah, there you go. Make a salad and it's dinner. So you know, that fig tree is going to give you an awful lot.
Oh, that's so awesome, Lynn. Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Enjoy Portland, Kate.
Thanks so much, Lynn. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
She's going to love Portland. The farmer's market, I mean, there are a lot of them all over Portland, but the main farmer's market in the city, it's one of the great ones. It's just gorgeous. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. And remember, reach us any way you want. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or actually pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Tom Wilson, who said, "Mosquitoes remind us that we are not as high up on the food chain as we think." The Splendid Table is produced by APM American Public Media. Go over to splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Find info on our latest ebooks and podcasts. There are loads of recipes and ideas. And be sure to register for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's all at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Our theme music is composed by Sam Keenan. Sally Swift's our managing producer. See you next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.